This episode is brought to you by Michigan Economic Development Corporation. In Michigan, you can have both a rewarding career and a quality lifestyle with plentiful career opportunities in world-changing, innovating industries, from electric vehicles to clean energy to biotech, with room for advancement no matter where you are in your career. Plus, Michigan offers a welcoming, beautiful, affordable, and inclusive community for all. Live your best life. You can in Michigan. Visit themichiganlife.org.
This episode is brought to you by PwC. When unprecedented times are all the time, it's time to start walking the talk. Leaders like you turn to PwC to see and stay ahead. Upskill your workforce, use intelligent automation, and transform big ideas into breakthrough reinvention. Explore the human-led, tech-powered solutions that help you reinvent. It's all part of the new equation. Learn more at pwc.com.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it, all while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello, and welcome to the call-in edition of Slate Money, the long-awaited call-in edition. We've been teasing this one for a while now, but this is finally your opportunity to get your questions answered. We have a whole bunch of really good questions, and we're going to try and run through as many of them as we can. We're going to save one just for the Slate Plus listeners at the end, because you guys are special. You get an extra Q and an extra A. But yes, I'm Felix Salmon of Fusion. I'm joined as ever by Jordan Weissman and Anna Szymanski.
Hey there.
Hey, hello, everybody.
Chaps. And let's go to the questions. Mr. Dan Schrader, producer of Slate Money, can you queue up for us question number one?
Hi, I'm wondering about the safety of my 401k and pension. We have a lot of money stored in there, and I'm just waiting for the world to explode any second, and I don't know if I should take it out now and spend it on something, not all of it, but like, you know, enough to like do some stuff around the house. Or if I should just hang on. I just feel like the stock market is out of control. It's just we're in a bubble and it's going to explode. And I just don't know when to start selling. So it'd be really helpful to know what you think. Thank you. Bye.
So I really love this question. I love a couple of great things about this question, which we can talk about a little bit. The first bit is where you talk about how you have money in your 401k and your pension, which kind of implies it's retirement money. But then you're like, should I take money out to spend money around the house? And when should I start selling? We can talk about the details, but the first thing is, if this is retirement money, it's not designed to be spent around the house. It's not designed to be sold. You don't try and time the markets. You just keep it in there. And then eventually, come retirement, you'll have some money for your retirement. But yeah, you're right. I mean, the stock market is looking pretty bubbly. And if you have a lot of money in there, and if you're going to feel bad if you didn't sell when the stock market goes down, because the stock market will go down at some point, then Anna, maybe you should be taking some money out and doing something useful with it instead of just watching it fall.
Well, this is long-term money, then you are going to expect to go through multiple market cycles. And also, ideally, actually, when the market goes down, that creates buying opportunities. So that's not a bad thing. And again, I would argue that, of course, the markets are going to come down. The question is just how much they'll come down. If this were money that you didn't really need, then maybe you could argue you could take some of it out and potentially do something else with it that would have a higher return. I'm not sure exactly right
now.
Not
a higher return, no. We're talking about spending it around the house. Actually, like, if you've made a bunch of money in the stock market by putting it in the stock market and the stock market rising,
yeah,
is there a case for taking some of those profits and buying a new kitchen?
Yeah, I mean, I could argue, again, if it's not money you need, if this was just like money you were kind of playing with, then sure, why not? I mean, that actually, you could probably say that's what a lot of investment firms are doing right now. Yeah. They're sitting on a lot of cash because they made returns and they're taking it out and holding it because there's nothing to invest in.
So I just kind of want to jump in here. She's talking about taking money out of a 401k because she's worried about the market dropping. If you do that, you pay penalties and taxes, and you may end up losing as much just from that as you would from a market correction. I wouldn't do that. I would just keep that money there. You know, theoretically, if you were talking about just taking money out of an E-Trade account, that might be that was sort of, like you said, your kind of play money. That would be a different story. I think in general, yeah, there are doomsday preppers out there, like hoarding gold and whatnot, because they think the world's going to explode. But if you're not going to go all, I don't know, plan for the future as if there's going to be a future. I think that's my general take on these things.
I would say there is a middle ground here, that you sound to me like someone, like everyone has a different risk tolerance. And you sound to me like you're scared and your risk tolerance is quite low, and that's fine. It is normal and reasonable and absolutely fine to have a relatively low risk tolerance. That doesn't mean you shouldn't have a 401k. You should have a 401k, but maybe it means that your 401k shouldn't be as heavily invested in the stock market as maybe yours is. So I think Jordan is right. Don't take money out of a 401k and spend it on your kitchen, because that will incur penalties. These are called retirement accounts for a reason. You're meant to keep them through to retirement. But if you can't afford to lose, say, 30% of the money in there, if that's going to cause you a whole bunch of grief and you aren't willing to accept that, then by all means, start moving money out of stocks and into something a bit safer. You can move into like short-dated bond funds or something like that, which are not going to lose nearly as much of their value if and when the stock market crashes. And if you have a low tolerance for risk, if you can't afford a large drawdown, if you don't want to see your investments fall in value, then yeah, you can move out of the stock market and into something else. That's different from spending it in cash.
Yeah, I guess I'd add one other thing, which is, if you really do have immediate needs, like your stove is broken or something, like you really need to fix something in your house, it's not crazy to take some money out of your paycheck and spend on that rather than saving it right now. Just because right now asset value, as we talked about this on the show all the time, are really high. The stock market is bubbly. Yields on bonds are low. At moments like this, you don't typically expect money put in the market now to have a great return later on. Like, I don't think your fear there is crazy. So if you're thinking about maybe making a slightly smaller 401k contribution this year because there's something you really need to do, that's not nuts. That's a reasonable decision, I think. But don't go raiding your 401k. That's all. I do what Felix says, change the allocation.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Okay, Mr. Dan Schrader, who's next?
Hi, Felix and team. This is Peter from Westchester. My question for you all is about the national debt. On this week's show, Jordan mentioned that he wasn't too worried about deficits. But it seems to me the deficits have been adding up over the years, and debt shows no sign of going south. So with the debt continue to grow and GDP growth being projected to be slow and government spending likely to grow, my question is, when do we start worrying about deficits and the debt? When public debt is 100% of GDP, 120%? It seems a bit like global warming to me, and it's going to get serious. And if we don't start to do something about it soon, it's going to be very hard to tame. Anyway, love the show. I'm a happy Slate Plus member. Thanks a lot. Bye.
Thanks, Peter. Thanks for listening to the November 4th episode. And yes, you're right that the debt to GDP ratios look like they're rising. Anna, do you remember the debate about Reinhardt and Rogoff?
Yes. I feel like this time is different.
This is the classic Reinhardt and Rogoff question. So for the purposes of Peter, who may not have heard of Reinhardt and Rogoff, who are they and what did they say about debt to GDP ratios?
They're economists who wrote a very well-regarded book called This Time is Different and have written quite a bit about the significance of debt to GDP and the point at which it becomes a problem and becomes unsustainable. They are often talking about markets that aren't quite as developed.
Well, there's a specific paper. So there was a very famous paper around the time, around like 2010, right after the recession, like got a lot of attention, which was, it said that when a country crosses the 90%, I believe, debt to GDP ratio, the economy starts to suffer and slow down. And this was cited often as a rationale for austerity in the US and Europe, around the world. There were two issues. One was the Excel error heard around the world. It turned out that they had screwed up some of their spreadsheets and that had sort of altered some of their findings, which was kind of a sad slapstick way for this paper to end up, because they are two very good, well-regarded economists, regardless of what you thought of this paper. And they've made a lot of interesting contributions. But the second thing was just whether or not they were confusing correlation with causation. No matter how many, you know, fancy regressions they ran and controls, to some extent, it seemed like a lot of these countries may have been piling up more debt because their economies were slowing, not vice versa. And so there's been this, I guess, you know, long-running existential question that, you know, Peter asks, how much debt is too much debt? Do we know? And I think there's definitely one school that says there's really no point where debt ever matters. You can go like full on, you know, MMA theory, modern monetary theory. Or there's another school which is very concerned about it. I think the answer is we just don't know. We know there are countries like Japan that can have like a 250% debt to GDP ratio, and their economy doesn't seem to be suffering from they can't even get enough inflation, which is something that you would expect to associate with high debt levels. You'd expect higher interest rates. I think so. Insofar as when I said I'm not worried about deficits, it's just like if there is a magic threshold, which it's not clear there is for any country that prints its own currency, because you can always print your own currency. It just doesn't seem like I find it hard to believe we're close to it.
Again, I think it's important to remember that it depends on the stage of development of the economy, because that's going to then relate to the confidence that other countries and foreign investors have in that country's ability to pay their debt.
Yes, I think so. That's so right on. And you see these like hyperinflation issues in these, you know, developing countries, that I think a lot of it is institutions. If you have a functioning government, people are going to think you're going to make good on what you owe. If you do not, if you're Venezuela
or Zimbabwe. I mean, that was why you had the exact same thing happen again, because people lost confidence in the monetary policy, in the government's ability to run its own economy.
Exactly. So it's like it's a political economy question. It's not just, is there some magic line?
Exactly. And I also think it's important to remember that when you're thinking about debt, people often think about it in relation to like a person, like the amount of debt that a person has. And that's a problem. And I think it's very important to remember that countries are very different than people. Again, people cannot, in fact, print their own currency. It is quite...
Oh, you can have an ICO.
That's true. Maybe you can print your own currency now.
You can't, Anna.
Yeah, that's true. But no, I do think this is just important to remember that there's nothing wrong with having deficits and there's nothing wrong with having a debt. I mean, traditionally, you want to have cyclical deficits. Having structural deficits may be a separate issue, but it's part of this cycle of the economy. It actually helps economies run more efficiently in a lot of ways.
And
yeah, I mean, where would we be if we couldn't point to sovereign yield curve?
Exactly. So I just want to say one thing, which, you know, Peter and some of the listeners, and I find it kind of remedial, but people always say, you know, we're going to become the next Greece, right? You know, oh my God, if we keep piling it up, we're going to become the next Greece. And what you always have to remember is just that these individual European countries do not print their own currency. They are on the euro. And that makes all the difference. It's why countries that are pegged to the dollar, for instance, often have issues with, you know, financial scares. And in the case of Europe, why people really thought Greece might run out of money because it could not create more. That is just not a situation you run into if you print your own currency.
Dan Schrader, let's have number three.
Hi, Slate Money. This is Michael in Colorado. I know that the U.S. stock markets recently switched from T+3 trade settlements, where your trade is actually officially done 3 days after you make it, to T+2 settlement. My question is, why is it that in this day and age of everything being electronic, there's no more paper stock certificates, why do we have anything other than, you know, T+0 or I guess maybe T+1 at the worst? Why do we need those couple extra days for trades to really settle? Is somebody making money off of that, or is it really that hard to make it all work out? Thanks.
Okay,
I'm going to take
so
this one.
Excited.
I'm really going
to
take
so
this
excited.
One.
So excited. I wanted to answer this, but I'm happy to give it to Anna.
I'm sitting back for this question. Go.
Okay, I think it's important to remember, a few things. One, it used to be way back in the day, trades actually settled more quickly. It wasn't until the 60s, actually, that you really started to expand to like T+5 because you had so much paperwork. But now we've been shortening that span. But I think it's really important to remember that even in this day and age where you think everything is electronic and it's really easy to settle, it is not easy as you think it is, especially depending on the type of securities that you're trading. Also, I think it's important to remember that when you're trading, you're often trading on money you may not immediately have. By which I mean, like, say you're a private equity firm and you have $1 billion of commitments. You don't have $1 billion sitting in your bank account. You do capital calls. And how quickly your client's fund can range from 2 days to 10 days. So it can make it very complicated to manage your cash when you're trading. And if trades settle very quickly, that can make managing your cash quite a bit more complicated.
Okay. So I find that answer not particularly satisfying to Michael in Colorado, because he's talking about the stock market.
Yeah,
he's talking about liquid public equities, not weird private equity capital calls. And let me make my own stab at this one, because there's this general feeling that, you know, I mean, clearing and settlement has always been the most boring bit of the market, and you can more or less ignore it. And it's good if it's boring, and it's good if you can ignore it. More recently, there has become this idea that faster is better. And if you can settle these trades more quickly, that would be a good thing. And shouldn't we try and do everything faster? And I guess my question is, why is faster better? I don't see a problem. If you are trading in the stock market, I'm perfectly happy to assume that you're basically a rich person. You can wait a couple of days to get your money if you want to sell your stocks. I think you should be able to wait a couple of days, and you probably shouldn't have stocks if you can't wait a couple of days. And more to the point, things happen in the stock market. You get weird flash crashes, you get obscure like glitches in the way that things trade, and you want to be able to reverse those trades. You want to be able to have enough time, if something completely crazy happens, to step in, go back to the stock exchange, work out what went wrong, cancel out trades which were bad, and just keep on going. So I personally am perfectly happy with relatively slow settlement, just because it gives people a bit of time to sort out the inevitable mistakes, and also because no one needs money that quickly.
Can I ask? I want to actually just reiterate a part of his question, though, because it seems like Michael is concerned that this might be some sort of inefficiency, that there are some middlemen just skimming money off the system because we haven't gotten better at it. Is that the case, or is there some valuable service, or is it just not adding much cost?
So it used to be called playing the float, where you were kind of making money off of this, but because of the way kind of fees and rates are right now, it's really negligible. You aren't making a ton of money by like holding assets that technically should have already settled. It's really not that big of a deal anymore. The reason it hasn't changed it's only changed to T+2 is really more because of inertia. And also I agree with Felix. I think part of it is to keep a more like stable market. Because again, things do happen. Also, trades don't always match. I mean, there are a lot of problems that I think people outside of the market don't understand, that these things aren't quite as simple as it might appear on the outside.
And I'll just jump in and say that, yeah, the thing about T plus two is that you agree to a trade on Monday at a certain price, like $75 a share. And then the settlement happens on Wednesday at $75 a share. But the actual transfer of the money from the buyer to the seller happens on Wednesday. It's not like the buyer pays on Monday and then the seller gets on Wednesday and there's some intermediary sitting on the money for 2 days and making interest. The settlement happens on Wednesday. So I wouldn't worry too much about like some greedy intermediary making money in the middle.
This episode is brought to you by Michigan Economic Development Corporation. In Michigan, you can have both a rewarding career and a quality lifestyle with plentiful career opportunities in world-changing, innovating industries, from electric vehicles to clean energy to biotech, with room for advancement no matter where you are in your career. Plus, Michigan offers a welcoming, beautiful, affordable, and inclusive community for all. Live your best life. You can in Michigan. Visit themichiganlife.org.
Okay, let's do something more fundamental and like
spiritual.
Spiritual. Do you have a spiritual question for us?
Quite a question.
Hi guys. So my question is about financial reporting in general. I get this vibe sometimes when I'm listening to not just your podcast but other financial news, or when I read a story about Chipotle being downgraded because they pay their employees too much. When I hear a story like that, or I see a story like that, I think of what kind of ghoul could write this without completely condemning the entire system. And the same thing when I listen to, on your podcast, you talk about unemployment being low, but not talking about the types of jobs those are absolutely abysmal. I guess my question is, are these moral questions something you guys talk about before the mic turns on? Or is it completely eliminated from the discussion to begin with? Do you have to be a ghoul to be a financial reporter, or is that something they kind of feed into you once you get in there? I'm not saying everyone there at Slate Money is a ghoul. I'm saying there's just a lot of humanity that is completely removed from financial reporting, much like how after Trump was elected, the stock market shut up. So I guess my question is, how do we change it without nationalizing everything? Thank you very much, and I hope you answer this question.
And that's an awesome question. And the answer is no, you can't change it without nationalizing everything. So so yeah, if you want to move to a world where you have a perfect alignment between sort of labor and capital and human happiness and profit, then yeah, you want common ownership of the means of production. And
I'm going to disagree with that.
I'm not saying that
world would be better than the world we live in, but I'm just saying that. Yeah, I think that nationalizing everything is one solution to this problem.
Well, so I think this is interesting because I don't consider myself a financial reporter. You know, I'm on this show we talk a lot about finance, but, you know, my day job is kind of a policy and econ writer. And I think most people other than Slate Money listeners think of me as sort of a lefty pundit at this point. Like, I mean, that's how I get quoted. And so I spend a lot of time ranting and raving about inequities in the world and in politics and policy and finance, whatnot. But I think, yeah, to some extent, if you want to talk about these issues on a granular level, especially when you are writing for, you know, if you're writing for a Wall Street Journal audience, if you're writing for a business audience, you can't spend every other paragraph talking about how ordinary families are getting screwed. You can try and work that in a little bit, but I don't think you have to be a ghoul. You just have to know who you're writing for and who you're talking to.
What the story is.
Yeah.
Because it is absolutely possible and legitimate to look at every story in America through a kind of human interest lens of like, what does this mean for the worker? And that's not what we do on this show, because I feel like there are other lenses which are also interesting, not least the sort of flip side of that coin, which is what does this mean for capital, for the investor? Like, we had a question just earlier in this show about someone who was worried about her 401k going down in value, which is, you know, you could, what you could say, I suppose, was you should hope that your 401k goes down in value, because that will be a sign that labor is finally having primacy over capital and that workers are being better treated and that companies are paying their workers better or something like that. But it's, I don't think that's a very satisfying answer.
No, I agree. And I guess I'll say I probably come at this from a slightly different angle, just in the sense that if you think people are ghoulish in how financial reporters talk about these things, you should see how it happens, like, really behind the scenes, where sometimes it's more that it is true that you, especially if you're in, like, emerging markets where you're often dealing with areas where there is potentially war and famine, and you are in meetings where you have people entirely talking numbers. And yeah, I do think that there actually can be sometimes certain people who are troubled by that. And I do think that there is also a problem, I think, sometimes in the market right now where you're very much encouraged not to think about the larger ramifications. That's just not what you're encouraged to think. That's not your job. Your job is to make money for your clients. And so I think when you're talking about financial reporting, I think if anything, in a lot of the financial news, they very often talk about the larger ramifications. In the industry, not so much.
Yeah, I think also, you know, I almost want to throw this back at the questioner a little bit, because if you are writing for the Wall Street Journal or Reuters and about the markets or companies and...
But no, he's talking about us. He's talking about
Slate
Money.
He's talking about the whole financial press.
But like, let's keep it to Slate Money for the time being.
Well, no, I guess what I just want to say is if you try to turn everything into a commentary on class inequity, the guys who run companies aren't going to listen to you. They're not going to read what you have to say. Instead, they're just going to sit there and listen to CNBC. And like, I think CNBC is actually kind of ghoulish, because they aren't just like sort of morally neutral on a lot of this stuff. They are just like, they are like, yes, capital must fucking prevail. Like, that is, you know, that is not all. Obviously, like, John Harwood is not like that. But if you watch like their morning shows, for instance, it often feels that way. And so I guess, you know, a little bit of remove and being able to just discuss what's actually going on in the world. And even on our show, when we kind of step back and focus on sort of the 10,000 foot take on how all these pieces are moving, it is important for getting people to listen to you. But also, yeah, like Felix said, for actually understanding what's happening. Because if you only focus on the human carnage, you might actually miss the kind of fundamental forces at play.
And then the other thing, which is absolutely worth adding, is that, you know, I mean, just speaking personally, I don't actually believe in common ownership of the means of production. And I don't think that is necessarily the right solution to whatever ails this country. And I think that often the profit motive and the, you know, treating your people well motive are not in conflict with each other. And if you look at the most successful companies in America right now, if you look at Google and Facebook and Apple and Netflix or whatever, you don't hear a lot of stories about how, you know, they're based on slave labor. And
well,
the people
contractors.
Well, so some of them have contractors, but the employees of those companies are doing well. The people who are happily buying iPhones are getting value out of those iPhones. There's a lot of value being created by those companies, not just for shareholders, but also for the country and the world as a whole. And I think that's worth celebrating occasionally.
I agree. And I think that sometimes there's a tendency to act as though, like, business is kind of a necessary evil and capitalism is a necessary evil and we kind of deal with this, but wouldn't it be better if we didn't have to? And I guess I just pretty thoroughly disagree with that. I mean, I'm someone who's a big believer in having kind of a healthy dialogue between capital and labor, between business and government. And sometimes one is a little bit more in the forefront, one is sometimes is the other. But I think that if you look historically, standard of living globally has improved because of the profit motive. That is, I think, pretty universally a fact. Of course, I realize you could argue environmental devastation, that's a separate issue. But I do think it's important to sometimes remember that the simple story that I think we sometimes think about capitalism is not always the only story.
And the one story which we come back to over and over again on Slate Money, which is the biggest story, biggest financial and economic story in the world, is China. And the fact is that when China had common ownership of the means of production, there was mass immiseration of the population. And when China moved to a capitalist system, that did amazing things for the wealth and well-being of the Chinese population. And you've seen spikes in health and body weight and life expectancy and literacy and all of the things that we like, not just in China, around the world. But like, China is a great example of how capitalism can create these things. And so while it's possible to be ideological about these things, I think you also have to be empirical too.
Slate Money, capitalism is good.
I mean, I think some two-thirds of Slate Money says capitalism's great. One-third is like, you know, appropriate amount of capitalism is...
If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
But that's an excellent segue, actually, to question number five.
Hi there, Alexander Hoffman, long-time listener, first-time caller. I have a question that I would like each of the crew to answer about the others. That is, what are the differences in values or perspectives that the three of you bring to your view of these topics? And how do you think that the others differ from you? Thank you very much. I'll take my answer off the air.
You'll get your answer on the air. So this is a great question. And I'll go first. Why not?
I'm going to put one rule, Felix.
Yep.
You cannot use the word millennial.
I was not going to use the word.
You can't.
Word
millennial. I'm preempting it though. Okay.
No, I was not going to use the word millennial. So yeah, Jordan is the. So I'm a technocrat at heart, I think, and I basically rely on Jordan to care about politics because I kind of hate politics. And as we have seen increasingly over the past couple of years, politics, especially American politics, becomes increasingly important, and I just have no appetite for caring about like the minutiae of congressional whatevers. And so as what happens in Washington becomes increasingly important financially and economically for America and the world, I find that Jordan's ability to care about that stuff rather useful. And the really great thing about Anna is that she comes out of the trading world, out of the buy side, out of people who actually need to make money by buying and selling securities and things in the world. And in that world, you can't be ideological. If you walk into that world with a preconceived notion of what the world should be and you try and place bets accordingly, you will lose all of your money very quickly. You rapidly realize that the conventional wisdom is nearly always right and that you need to understand why the world is as it is. And for all that we all have our priors and we all like love to talk about how things are broken and they're easy to fix. The fact is that mostly things are as they are for a reason. And I find Anna very good at sort of being unideological about these things and just reminding us all of the sort of inconvenient facts of the market. But anyway, I'd love to hear from you both.
So I think that actually sums up, I think, a lot of basic dynamic on this show. I would say, I think I've also sort of maybe changed the way I approach these issues since we started this 3.5-4 years ago. I think I used to sort of be like a just kind of wonky and academic about a lot of stuff. That was like, the joke was like, I would always give some argue, like some answer about the natural rate of unemployment when something came up, and Felix would be like, no, it's like a fucking like momentum trade or something. That would be like, and that was sort of fundamentally, I'm not someone who cares about finance qua finance. I'm sort of someone who cares about politics and the economy and how you make it run and how you make the, you know, how we can all kind of get along in this world. And as a result, I care a lot about what goes on in Washington. I'm sort of provincial in that sense. I've always thought of Felix as someone who actually like enjoys both the art and folly of finance as sort of for, on an aesthetic level. But at the same time, has a very high low view of the, like likes like kind of 10,000 foot views of what's going on globally, and actually likes thinking and kind of synthesizing all of that. Whereas I'm sort of in the middle, like kind of trying to figure out what the hell's going on in Congress. And I think that dynamic, it's useful to have both of those. And I agree that Anna is actually the person who knows how the shit works. And that's like actually like really, really important, because, you know, I remember I one time had a conversation with, you know, I one time I had a conversation with Kathy about what it would take to get a really in-depth discussion, like understanding of a finance, like just a granular level. Is it possible as an outsider to really do it? And her answer as someone who had been sort of in and out was, no, you really can't. Like, it's almost impossible to have that, like, just be even, she had said that having been out of it for a while, she felt like she didn't know anything anymore. It was just like, you know, it moves too quickly and people are too willing to lie to you all the time. And so actually having someone who kind of is there in the trenches and smarter than most people who are in the trenches and actually thoughtful about it is, I think, an important dynamic.
Well, appreciate that. Yeah, and I would say, again, I've really enjoyed this year of being on the show, and it's been very interesting. I mean, I feel like I've definitely appreciated, I feel like Jordan has a kind of depth of understanding about U.S. politics that I really appreciate, and also in a way that I think, although obviously comes, I think, from, is a liberal, but I think is also not a kind of knee-jerk and just believing the kind of consensus is really also thoughtful.
Yeah, I am getting closer to full communism. I am like, after the tax bill, I'm just like, I'm inching there. But that's, anyway.
No, and I've also really enjoyed, again, because I do come from a background where I think there is like, there are, I mean, look, I'm someone who, I like structure, I like spreadsheets, I like order, I like rules, and it's been kind of fun to sometimes have discussions with Felix where he'll often come at things from an angle that frankly just never would have occurred to me. And it's been really interesting to be like, oh, because it is true. When you're in a certain world, not that everybody thinks exactly the same. I mean, you call yourself a contrarian investor, but at the end of the day, like, again, there are certain just things you assume. And then when people question those, you're like, well, that's actually a very good question. And so I think that that's been a really interesting dynamic that we've had on the show.
I will
Why
say,
do those endowments always need to go up in value?
I'm still gonna hold that I'm right about that one.
I will say, politically, we obviously span a fairly narrow band of the left. But like, honestly, I don't think that's necessarily a problem. If you want, you know, if you want right wing people talking about finance, their entire TV networks devoted to that. So
yeah, and I also though would, just a side note, but that like, a lot of people in finance are actually not quite as conservative as I think sometimes people on the outside think that they are.
That's true. I've even met like Rentec people, like who literally make money for Robert Mercer, who are actually pretty liberal. So,
So yeah, that is it for us this week. Thank you for listening to Slate Money. Keep on sending us those emails, slatemoney@slate.com. Listen to Lexicon Valley, which is hosted by John McWhorter, comes out every other Tuesday. It's a podcast about language and syntax and pet peeves and etymology and neurolinguistics and all manner of sexy stuff like that. So that's at slate.com/lexiconvalley. Many thanks to Dan Schrader for producing. We will talk to you next week on Slate Money.
Do you ever feel like there's nothing new in the news? You know there are urgent things happening in the world around you, but all you hear is noise. That's why we made What Next. Our goal is to tell you the stories you haven't heard before, or maybe a different side to the story you thought you already knew all about. I'm Mary Harris, the host of What Next. And I love my job because it helps me cut through the noise of the news. And then I get to bring it to you. Together, we can figure out what next.